So, the last talk of this season of talks is, what is it, about death and dying and beyond. Because tomorrow I will be dying from KL and I'm going beyond to Penang. But don't worry, because when we die, we always get reborn, so I have to come back again. But in each of these series of talks, I'm giving talks about things which affect your daily life, and to try and make sure you understand that you don't need to shed so many tears when some loved one of yours dies. You don't have to worry when you die. As a Buddhist, you've done it many times before, only this time get it right when you die. And so many other people have died, and after a while you get to understand that death is part of life. It's no big deal. Life and death is just, you know, this world we live in. And you'll soon understand that every time you start crying when a loved one dies, you're not crying for them, you're only crying for yourself. So really, it's not a sign of love that you feel sad and grief-stricken that someone has died. If you really love them, you will let them go. Because sometimes that when a person especially is very old or very sick, they are in great pain and they're ready to go. And what do? You say, "Don't go, Mum. Don't leave me, Dad." And what do you mean? They've got to suffer some more because of you? That's not filial piety. So, if your parents or loved one is really suffering, it's a wonderful thing to let them go. Remember, years and years ago, there was a couple, Jenny and Steve. Jenny was an Australian nurse, Steve was from the United States. And he had made his own very successful business, taking people white water rafting around the world. He was such a fit and strong man, and very skilled in these little inflatable boats, going to these remote parts of the world, doing white water rafting. Not only did he enjoy his life, but also he made a lot of money as well. And it just happens that even the fittest people, they also get sick. And he got cancer, and it was incurable. And so in his last months, I would go and visit him. Visit him in their little unit over in Perth as he got closer and closer and closer to death. And there was one occasion when I went to see him that I realized there was something wrong, that he was very sick and should be very close to dying, but he wasn't. He was lingering on a stage of dying but not making any more progress. And I realized what was going on. And I turned around to his wife, Jenny, and I looked at her and said, "Jenny, have you given your husband permission to go yet?" And she looked at me and didn't say a word. She actually understood that I had hit the nail on the head. She climbed on the bed, put her hands around her husband, Steve, and said, "Darling, I give you permission to die. You don't have to struggle so hard to stay alive for me. I love you so much that I let you go." And it was one of those wonderful events where I just stood back and watched them kiss, watched them embrace, and watched them show such amazing love that they let each other go. And a couple of days later, he died. He thought, that one of the worst things he could possibly do to the woman he loved the most in life was to make her sad by dying. And that's what was keeping him struggling in this cancer-ridden body, painful, weak, with no prospect. And that's all he needed, permission from the person he loved to let go and let nature take its course. And from that time on, I've often asked people that if you have a loved one who is dying, and if they're very, very close, and you feel that something is stopping them from being released from their aching, sick, and tired body. Please go up to them and give them permission to die. Because sometimes not doing that is keeping them in a prison of pain when they really should be letting go and going on to a new life. And I know that that also happened to a monk over in our monastery in England many years ago. I knew that monk because I grew up with him in Thailand, and they were very good friends because he was from Oxford and I was from Cambridge. We joke with each other that we're supposed to be enemies, but we were the best of friends. And he was from Tennessee, and when he was in Thailand he got two strains of typhoid at the same time. He survived that illness, but he had, I think, Crohn's disease as a result, which meant he was very, very sick. And we sent him to our monastery in England because we thought that he'd get better medical treatment in the UK than in Thailand at that time, 30 years or so ago. And at the monastery in England, he had the very best of medical care, both the normal type of medicine and all alternative therapies, but nothing worked. For a couple of years, he was bedridden, staying in an attic room of this monastery. And I remember going to see him and seeing this person who was a Rhodes Scholar, who was a champion wrestler in Tennessee, just wasted with hardly any energy. As he told me, his sickness was so bad that for days, for weeks, he was in bed. And on a good day, he tried to get out of the room for exercise, could only make it to the doorway before he collapsed and had to crawl back into bed. That's how weak he was. And it was the abbot of that monastery, that was Ajahn Sumedho. He had a moment of inspiration and insight. He went up to that monk's room after he'd been in it for a couple of years. Went up to the room, just the two of them. And he said to this ex-wrestler Rhodes Scholar, whose body was wasted and so weak, he said, "I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and the nuns in this monastery, on behalf of all the people who support us and all the people who love you and care for you, on behalf of all those people, I've come up here to give you permission to die. Stop trying so hard to get better." At which the monk started crying and weeping. He wept and wept and wept, and from that day on, he started to get better. And that was about 30 years ago, 28, 5 years ago now, and he's still alive, living in South Africa now. What a great story that is. You understand the psychology? We try so hard to get better, it makes us sick. Instead of just, as I've been telling all you in the meditation retreat, letting go and relaxing, and then you find there's a much better chance of healing when you're stopping fighting so desperately to get better, to please other people. So when a person is dying, please give them permission to die, because the psychology is, the worst thing I can possibly do to the people who look after me and care for me, who've done so much for me, is to make them sad and make them cry by dying. And that's a great stress on the person who is dying. In fact, the person who is dying, they have two problems. One is their own physical pain and sickness. The other is their relations. The relations often make it much worse for them. When you go into the room and you start crying, "Oh, you're dying, it's so sad." Imagine that was you dying there. That's the last thing you want, other people's problems. You've got enough problems on your own to look after. And that was one reason why I remember just counseling an Australian girl who was a Tibetan Buddhist nun. As I say, that I don't care what tradition you are from. If you're a Buddhist, you're my friend and I'll look after you and we'll be mates. All this separation between different sects and types of Buddhism, I don't agree with that at all. But anyway, she was a Tibetan Buddhist nun, I was a Theravada monk, and I was counseling her, and one day I got a call from her. She was in the hospice in Perth. And the call said that I really think I'm going to go soon. I'm going to die soon. Can you please come? People know when they're going. She actually died, I think, 36 hours later. And I knew that she was not faking this. So I stopped what I was doing and got a car and sort of was driven all the way from my monastery, about an hour and a half, to the place where the hospice was. Now, when you go to a hospice when people are that sick, you can't just barge into their room. I had to check in with the duty nurse first of all. I said my name, I said the name of the person I wanted to visit, and she checked the register and she said, "I'm terribly sorry, this woman has asked for no visitors." And I said, "That cannot be right. She just called me an hour and a half ago and requested me to come immediately." And the nurse got angry with me. She said, "We must respect the patient's wishes." And I said, "But I've come all the way from this Serpentine, an hour and a half away, and she told me to come." And the nurse glared at me. And she said, "Come with me." And so I followed her. And on the room, the bedroom where this Tibetan nun was staying, there was a big sign on the door. "Absolutely no visitors." And she read it out to me. "See, absolutely no visitors." And she was very pleased with herself that she'd actually told me off. But I've got very good eyes. I looked at the bottom and there were some other words scrawled in small print. And those words were, "Except Ajahn Brahm." That was there. Now, I know this was not a very good Buddhist thing to do. I admit that, but I could not stop myself by telling this nurse, "Except Ajahn Brahm, see?" And this nurse was very upset and she ran away. But before we go on to that story, another car, WTJ9963, WTJ9963, I give you permission to move. And you better move soon, WTJ9963. So, I went into her room. And of course, the first thing I did was ask her, "Why did you put that notice on the door? Why did you say absolutely no visitors except for me?" And what she said next really hit me hard. And I've shared that story with so many thousands of people. She said, "When all my relations and friends come in here and see me so thin and wasted because of my cancer, just all skin and bones, looking like some person from the Auschwitz concentration camp," she said, "they all get emotionally upset. They get so sad." And she said, "Again, I've got to deal with my own imminent death. I don't want to deal with their emotional problems, their grief and their fear and their pain at seeing me like this." And she said, "I'm the only one who goes in there and treats her like a person, not like a sickness." And from that time on, I realized, and I've taught other people, whenever you do go into a hospital and see a loved one, please talk to the person, don't talk to the sickness. Don't talk to the cancer. Don't say, "How are you feeling today?" Which is the dumbest question you could possibly ask. If they were feeling well, they wouldn't be in hospital, would they? So they're feeling sick. Don't ask them that. That's what the doctors and nurses sort of keep on saying. "How are you feeling today?" So you're a friend. You're a relation. Talk about anything else except their cancer, their illness, their imminent death. And she said, "That's what I do." I kept on telling her the latest jokes. So she said, "What's the latest joke, Ajahn Brahm?" She wanted to be treated as a person, as if she was happy and well and she just wanted to have a nice cup of coffee with her friend. That's how she wanted to be treated. So she taught me. She taught me how to deal with sick and dying people. Don't look at their death. Don't look at their sickness. There's a person there. Talk to the person. And that's what they really want. And if they want to talk about their death, then they'll ask about that, and then you can help them. But really, they're dealing with that in their own way. And the last thing they want is your emotional baggage planted on them. So if you really love the person you're visiting in hospital, if you really want the very best for them, then don't think of yourself and your fear and your pain. Empathize with them. They're dealing with it. What they want from you is permission to be sick, permission to be themselves, and eventually permission to pass away and die. And if you can do that, you free them. And so often many people have been sick in a hospital for weeks and also days and days, and that's really all they need to pass away. How many of you have been in a hospital with a dying person, holding their hand, talking to them, and they're not dying, and you just go out of the room to get some dinner or go to the toilet, and while you're away, they die? That is so common in my experience. The reason is because when the family are around, you don't let them die. You keep holding them on, and that's not a very wonderful thing to do. So please, let people die. There's nothing wrong with it. It's part of life. And when this body is old and sick, it's one of the best things to do. This is one story which I tell at funeral services in Australia. Because this was a story about these two elderly people. They'd been married for so many years. They were so close to each other that when one of them got sick and died, their partner died a couple of days later. I've seen that happen many times too. Husbands and wives, they're so close together. When one dies, the other one has got no meaning to life, and they almost will themselves to die. They're usually very old at that time anyway. So this couple died within days of each other, and so they appeared in heaven together. And when they appeared in heaven, they were met by an angel. And the angel said, "Sir, madam, because of your good karma, I've come to show you your eternal reward." And they took them to this incredible, opulent mansion overlooking the cliffs with million-dollar views of the ocean. And the angel said, "Sir, madam, because of all of your charity, looking after the Triple Gem Center and Wat Chaitra One, this is your reward." I always have to put a plug in for my sponsors, just like any other celebrity on TV or radio. So because of your generosity to the Triple Gem Center and Wat Chaitra One, you have this amazing, wonderful mansion which you would never be able to afford in your earthly life. Enjoy it. But the guy, the husband, took one look at that enormous building and said, "Look, I'm on a very small salary, I'm not wealthy, I won't be able to afford the government land tax." Because it's the case, isn't it, in Malaysia, the bigger the house, the more tax you have to pay. So he said, "How can I afford something like this?" And the angel said, "Sir, I let you into a secret. There is no government up in heaven. Nor is there any taxes. It's for free, okay? Enjoy." But there are taxes and governments here in KL, and so WGW503, please move your car, otherwise you'll never get a mansion in your next life. WGW503, please move your car. So then the angel took them inside the mansion. And you would not believe the furnishings in that mansion. Just all the chairs and the sofas, they were so soft. As soon as you sat down, you just went right into them. They had this plasma screen TV, 50 foot wide. And And if you were watching EPL soccer on there, your team always won. Because it was heaven. They had chandeliers from the ceiling, not with glass or crystal, but with pure diamonds. Even the toilet seat was made of gold, and the water which came out was fragrant with Chanel perfume. It was an amazing mansion. And when the angel had finished the guided tour of the mansion, he told the couple, "Sir, we've tried to make it the best for you because of your really, really good karma. Now, is there anything up here you don't like? If there is, here's my number. You can text me straight away and I will change it for you immediately." And the husband said, "Look, that's a huge TV screen. Those diamonds on the chandeliers just must be worth the king's ransom. Someone on my salary won't be able to afford the insurance premium." And the angel said, "Sir, insurance? What on earth do you need insurance for? We don't allow burglars up in heaven." "You don't need insurance, okay?" And then the angel took them down to a garage. Not a single garage, not a double garage, a triple garage. And in that triple garage were three amazing vehicles. The first was a state-of-the-art, actually much, much better than you find on Earth, four-wheel drive. Now that four-wheel drive could go anywhere. It could go up and down mountains. The Himalayas would be no problem for that. It was so powerful, that four-wheel drive could even go vertically up waterfalls. And the next vehicle was a stretch limo. And that was so big, it had a swimming pool inside. A stretch limousine. And the last vehicle was a limited edition Lamborghini. There's only 6 made on earth, and he had one of them up in heaven. He always wanted a fast car. You guys, when you always dream of a sports car and being behind the wheel of this powerful engine and vroom, going for broke. He'd always wanted one of those. He would get out the magazines and drool over the Ferraris and Lamborghinis and Aston Martins. But number one, he could never afford one. And number two, as he said to the angel, "What's the point of a fast car? The traffic in KO won't allow you to go fast. And even if you do go out onto the open road, there are too many policemen with their speed cameras." And the angel said, "Sir, number one, this is not KL. There is no traffic jams up in heaven. Number two, there are no police up in heaven with their speed cameras. This is heaven. You can go as fast as you like. And you don't have to worry about having an accident. You're already dead." So then the angel opened the garage doors. And on the opposite side of the road from the mansion was this immaculate, amazing 18-hole golf course. And the angel said, "Sir, we did our research. We found out what you liked on earth. We knew you liked fast cars, but your greatest love was golf. And now in your last years, you were too old and sick to play. But because of your good karma, we've made this 18-hole golf course on the opposite side of the road to your house. In fact," said the angel, This golf course was designed by Tiger Woods himself. He said, you may remember that a year or two ago, having had an argument with his wife, he crashed his car. Few people know that after crashing his car, he had a near-death experience for 5 minutes, at which time he came up to heaven to design your golf course. And he said, this is a heavenly golf course, which means as long as you get the ball on the green, as long as it's on the green, whichever way you putt that ball, it always curls into the hole. Have any of you played golf and it's rimmed the hole or just stopped an inch before it goes into the hole and how much suffering that is? Not in heaven, no, that goes in the hole every time. And he looked at that golf course. You know, just like in Malaysia, some of those golf courses are only for the elite. You have to get elected into the club, first of all. You have to have connections. And he said, look, I probably won't ever be elected in. I haven't got connections. And even if I was, I would never be able to afford the annual fees. And the angel rolled his eyes and shook his head in disbelief. He said, sir, look, this is heaven. There are no fees up in heaven. And you're already a member. Not a life member, a death member. You can play whatever you like for nothing, okay? And then he left the couple with their golf course, their Lamborghini, their amazing mansion with 15-meter wide plasma screen TVs, and an incredible mansion with million-dollar views. And as soon as the angel left, that was when the husband started scolding his wife. He got really angry at her and started shouting at her, cursing her, and saying really bad things about her. And she just could not understand why. And when he took a pause for breath, that's when she said, why are you so angry? We've got this beautiful mansion with million-dollar views. We've got this amazing furniture inside. You've got your fast sports car. You can go as fast as you like, and your golf course on the other side of the road. Why are you so upset? And he looked at her with eyes like a monster, willing to tear out her throat. Because, wife, if it wasn't for all that health food you gave me, I could have been up here years ago. So, how many of you take health food? What are you doing that for? You could have a Lamborghini by now. Now, of course, you know the reason I tell that story is because why are you so afraid of death? It's amazing. We're so afraid of death, we'd do anything to stop getting our Lamborghini and golf course. And sometimes we go too far. Seriously. Sometimes we've got such a fear of death that anything, we do anything to keep ourselves and other people alive. And sometimes it goes too far. Sometimes in hospitals, the doctors keep reviving you, keep pushing all sorts of tubes and injections and stuff into you, anything to keep you alive, because they're terrified of letting you die. It's because of that I've told many people in that profession, doctors and nurses, psychologists, therapists, anybody who's treating people who are very sick, your job, your main priority, is not to cure that person. Please don't think that a doctor's job is to cure the sickness. The doctor's job, the nurse's job, the therapist's job is not to cure, but to care. to care for the person. Because if your job is to cure, you will often fail. With all the resources at your disposal in a modern hospital, you'll try and try and fail sometimes. People die despite your efforts. And many Buddhist doctors would come to me and they would feel so upset. They think they'd failed. That their patient, who may had a wife and young kids, died under their care. And they thought, I failed. I didn't cure them. And they come to me for counseling. I said, that was not your job to cure them. Your job was to care for them. How did they die? Did they die knowing they were being cared for? Did they realize that the hospital staff was so loving and so compassionate that they had this wonderful last few days or few moments of their life? They were cared for. And if you as a doctor or as a nurse or therapist, whatever, if you know that your main job in life is to care for the people in those beds in your hospital, then you never need to fail. Never once. No matter what the sickness or disease is, you can always care, but you can't always cure. And really, that should be the main priority. Because if you care for a person and you give that compassionate care all the resources at your disposal, a lot of times they do survive the treatment. A lot of times they do get better. Compassion is the greatest of healers, as many of you should know from your own experience. I learned that when I was a kid in London. I mentioned to many people that I came from a very poor home. And so I spent a lot of time in my youth playing soccer in the street. Not in the backyard or a field, because there wasn't any around. We just played soccer in the road. And if you went for a tackle and you fell over, then you scraped the skin off your knee. I don't know how many times I'd run to my mother as maybe a 6 or 7 year old. Mummy, mummy, look, I'm bleeding. And my mother would put her mouth on that wound and kiss it better. It would always heal and immediately the pain would go away. Later on, when I learned some biology, I realized that my mother was putting a mouthful of germs on an open wound. That should have got infected, but it never did. Why? It's because compassion was much more powerful than biology. It always worked and the pain went away. I think you know that. You've had experiences like that. A mother, a loved one, comes up to you and you're in terrible pain, and just because they're there for you, whether it's a kiss or a stroke or a kind word, much if not all of your pain vanishes. Never underestimate the therapeutic effect of compassion and kindness. So if we had hospitals whose staff was taught that their main duty is not to cure, but to care, I think that would change much of the way we deal with people with cancer and other sicknesses in our modern hospitals. For those who have actually been through the hospital service, do you ever feel you are cared for? Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you think you're just like a piece of material going in one end and just being on some sort of factory conveyor belt where people assess your symptoms by machines, where you hardly ever see the doctor. I remember this joke I once read about this person who rang the hospital and said, I'm inquiring about Mrs. Jones in Ward 10, Room 3. Can you please tell me how she is? And the person on the reception desk say, wait a moment, I'll just look at the records. And they looked at the records and said, oh, you know, your relation, Mrs. Jones, in Ward 10, Room 3, that, you know, she's getting better. The doctor thinks she may be released tomorrow. And the lady on the end of the phone, thank you, I'm Mrs. Jones in Ward 10, Room 3. My doctor never tells me anything. I think you're laughing because you understand sometimes that's true. So remember, caring is the most important, and it means you can always succeed. Which means also when a person's dying, when the disease is untreatable, people don't try their damnedest to cure the person at all costs, because cure is not the most important, care is. Which means no more will we get people dying in hospitals in such agony and discomfort because we want to cure them at all costs, even at the cost of their comfort in their last few hours of their life. And care, compassion, kindness becomes the main priority instead, which means we let them die with dignity, with respect, with comfort, without the intervention of modern techniques, which just might work, but the likelihood is that they won't. So we discard those extreme options which have limited chance of success, because care is more important. Wouldn't that be the way you want to die? For me it would. Sometimes I've been in these hospitals in Australia and other parts of the world, and I felt so disturbed by just how much discomfort the patients are feeling at the very end, simply because the doctors are terrified the person might die on them. So much so, they subject the patients to such degrees of discomfort rather than just letting them die. So this is a crusade to allow the priorities to change, instead of always trying desperately to avoid death, to accept death as part of life, and to allow death with dignity, death with care, with compassion. And half of that problem is your problem, because sometimes you fight too hard to keep your loved one alive. Filial piety means loving your parents, not always making them suffer to keep them alive. To love them, you want the very best for them. And you know if they've been good people. All religions know if a person's lived a good life, they're going to have a good rebirth. And the state of their body in this moment, before they die, is painful and awful. Let them go, for goodness sake. This afternoon, at the Malaysian Buddhist Cooperative, I was telling some stories about what happens to a person when they actually do die. Don't think you have to wait till you die before you know what's going to happen. There's many people have already done that. They've died and they've come back to tell the tale. It's called near-death experiences, NDEs. And if you really want to have more information on NDEs, just get on Google, NDE. And it's amazing just what information you have, because so many people have had those experiences. And one of the stories I told was of this woman in England who died on an operating table, and she eventually came back, but before she came back, she had this experience which she related to everybody. First of all, when she died, her body floated up above the operating table. She could see and hear everything which was being said. Don't ever think that these are just fantasies and illusions. What you see, what you hear during these experiences on the operating table have been known to be accurate, true records of what really happened. One of the most impressive of these near-death experiences, which showed that this was a real experience, not imaginary, was when another person, they died in an operating table, I think in the United States, I think it was, and they floated up above the table, high towards the ceiling. Now these operating theatres, they don't have windows at eye level, They don't want people looking in to see what you're doing to Granny. There are windows, but they're very high up, just to give light into the operating table, but not to give views either in or out. So she floated up to the eye level of these high windows, where she noted there was a tennis shoe on the ledge, which could not be seen from people on the ground level. So when she came back from her out-of-the-body experience, and she told her doctors and nurses what had happened, and she said she floated high up and there was a tennis shoe on the ledge of the window, none of them believed her. They say, how on earth could a tennis shoe get up there? But of course she insisted, until eventually someone got a ladder so they could see what was on the ledge. And of course there was a tennis shoe on the ledge. How she could see that could only have been if her experience of floating out of her body and rising high above the table was actually real, as it is. But this other story was of this English lady who died on the operating table, and like most people, and that's the reason I'm telling this story, and almost everybody who dies loved the experience. It's the most peaceful, beautiful, wonderful experience you've ever had in your whole life, unless you've meditated. Peaceful, blissful, wonderful. It's actually exactly the same you get in meditation. That's why I said that. But she said she was having such a wonderful time, so blissful, so joyful, so free of pain, so light. She was having a ball out of her body until she met a spirit. And the spirit said, you're not supposed to die yet. It's not your karma. You've got to go back. And she said, no, I'm not going back. The spirit said, you have to. She said, no way. And they had this argument. She didn't want to go back to her body. It was just too nice outside. Spirit said, you have to. And in the end, the spirit got hold of her and threw her into her body. And she was so upset afterwards. And in the interview, which I saw on the BBC, she said, when I really die next time, I'm going to find that damn spirit. I'm going to sort him out. I'm going to tell him off. What he did to me, I was having a wonderful time being dead, and now he made me alive again. Now that's standard, that when you die, you have a wonderful time. It's much better out of your body than in. And I say that, so number one, you are not scared of your own death. The dying is the painful part, so get it over as quick as possible and get to the other side. Get to your Lamborghini and golf club. And it also means that those of you who've lost a loved one, a mother, a father, a son, a daughter, don't ever think they're suffering. They are having a wonderful time out of their body. It's you're the one who's suffering. That's why I say you're crying for yourself when you shed tears of grief. You're not crying for the person who's died. So please understand that. And if you don't believe me, just go and have an operation and just die on the table and flood out and see what's going on. If you can't do it yourself, trust people who've done it before you and get on that internet and find out all these stories. And these are not just Buddhists. One of the other stories I told this afternoon is of an Australian politician. He was a senator. He just retired about a year ago. Senator Graham Edwards. He was an Australian soldier during the Vietnam War, and his friend was slightly wounded, and because he was thinking of his friend, not looking where he was stepping, he stepped on a landmine and blew off his legs. And he told what happened. He said there was this blinding flash of light, incredible pain, but only for a couple of seconds. And the next thing he knew, and these are his exact words, which he wrote in an article in a magazine, the next thing he knew was floating above the paddy fields of Vietnam without a care in the world, so free, so blissful, so light, so at peace. Classic description of what happens after you die. He said he didn't know how long he was floating there, enjoying the bliss of being free from his body after death, when a thought came to his mind. It was the thought of his wife back in Perth, where I live. His wife had only about 3 or 4 weeks previously given birth to his first child, a son. And he thought, it's not right, as a father, I should abandon my new son and my wife. And with that thought that it wasn't right to abandon his family, he got drawn back into his body, felt the incredible pain again, but again only for a couple of seconds before he fell into unconsciousness, and the next thing he knew was waking up in the field hospital, starting the long journey to recovery. But he said and told what it was like to leave the body. Again, he was not a Buddhist. I don't think he's even a Christian. He's an atheist, agnostic, whatever. Not particularly religious. But that was his experience. The same as everybody's. So hopefully I've convinced you that dying is no problem. Even look forward to it. And then a lot of your fear of death will be taken away. And again, the dying process, as long as you're caring, giving permission to go, that's the greatest act of love you can ever give. As I often said, the greatest act of love is to let somebody go. In the same way, your children, you send your children to the best schools and universities. You spend so much money on their education here in Malaysia. And then what do? They go marry someone in Canada. Bye-bye, Mum. Bye-bye, Dad. I'm living in Toronto. And as Mum and Dad, that hurts you. You want your kids to be happy, but you want to see them. You want to visit them. You want to hold and hug them. And now they're living on the other side of the world. We will always let them go because you love them so much. You want them to have their life and be happy. In the same way, you know, your mother, your father, whoever it is you love, when it's time to let them go with love. You go with my blessing, husband. Thank you for all those years that we have had together. And the last story, again I told this afternoon, this is a common story. I know that many people complain. Ajahn Brahm always tells the same stories and the same jokes. But until you can stop crying when somebody dies, I'll always tell this story again. Until it really gets inside of you to the point that you understand the story. And never shed a tear again when someone close to you dies. Again, this was the story of my own father's death. 16 years of age when he died, I was. Never cried at his funeral. Never cried since. I never felt sad when the father I love so much, the one who taught me the meaning of love, to open the door of your heart no matter what you ever do. I never cried. And it was such a strange experience, but everyone else in my family was shedding tears and I wasn't. And I remember that so clearly, that when I became a monk, when I had the wisdom to understand emotions. As a 16-year-old, you have emotions but you don't understand their power, what they are and where they come from. It takes a long time, especially for a man, a male, to get to know emotions through practice of mindfulness, to understand them so well. You can understand what they are and where they come from. It was only as a monk, when I really started to get to know my emotions, that I recognized that the emotion I felt at my father's death was similar to another emotion I often felt as a young man. It was the emotion I felt after a great concert. As a young man, I went to many concerts in London with girlfriends, with friends,
I love music, and you should all know the big city like London had some of the best orchestras, bands and musicians of the whole world. Rock, jazz, folk, classical, I went to them all. But I also know that at the end of every performance there was the encore. When you asked the band to play on for another 5 minutes, and they did. And at the end of the encore, the concert was over. And I knew that the chances of ever hearing such a band again were very limited. Probably it was the last time I would hear them. But when I walked out of those concert halls, clubs and pubs, never once did I shed a tear. Have you ever felt sad after a great concert? You don't feel sad. You feel what a great performance that was, and how special it was that I was there at the time. You feel blessed, you feel grateful. And that was exactly the emotion I felt at my father's death. What a great performance that was. How lucky I was to have been there at the time. Now, I know I've said that story before, but I say it again. When that's the time for your loved one's death, when they die and you do the service for them, are you going to look at their life like an amazing concert, a great time you've had together, with memories you'll never ever forget, and feel blessed, and feel grateful, and feel this beautiful sense of joy at what you've had? Or will you be like every other person who's stupid and go crying for yourself because you think of what you've lost, not what you've gained? You have a choice there with life and death. You can look at what you've had, or you can look at what you've lost. When you look at what you've lost, then you cry. When you look at what you've had, you feel this incredible love and inspiration. That's what I had when my father died. So death, if you understand it in a Buddhist way, is a beautiful moment. Just like, again, with concerts, the best part of the symphony was the end, the crescendo, when all the great themes of the concert came together, and it was incredibly powerful and moving at the finale, and then it all faded away again and the concert was finished. I live in Western Australia in a monastery which overlooks the Indian Ocean. Sunsets are glorious from our monastery. They are the best part of the day, just like the end of a life can be its very best part. Beautiful ending. What a great life. Thank you for being my friend. It's a different way of looking at death. And I'm talking about from the point of view of life, let alone for what's going to happen afterwards. All religions talk about what's going to happen after death, but this evening I've taught about what's happening before that event happens. If you want to find out what happens after death, then you have to come to another talk at another time, maybe in another life. Thank you for listening. 。Okay, now there's lots of questions, but before I ask the questions in the box, are there any questions from the floor about death and beyond? Yes.
Are you familiar with the Tibetan Book of Dead?
The Tibetan Book of the Dead, I am very familiar with that. When I got my first school prize, that was the book I got for my first school prize. I was supposed to get a book on mathematics. I really upset my maths teacher when I handed him the Tibetan Book of the Dead as my first school prize. I know that, yes.
Can you describe to us the steps
The steps involved in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that is only one experience of the death process. Not all death processes go the same steps. It is an example, it is not definitive. Many people die in different ways. The stream of consciousness leaving the body. Because I was a scientist, we've got more information since. Professor Pim van Lommel did some amazing research. He was the professor of medicine at three hospitals in the Netherlands. He wanted to find out about these near-death experiences, whether they were true or not. His sample group was every person from whatever race, religion, or gender who came into his three hospitals under cardiac arrest. The survivors were given questionnaires to see what happened, whether they had other body experiences. And he recorded what happened in the triage area, in the emergency rooms, operating theatres, to find out if what they said they experienced out of their body was true or not. He found out about 10% of the survivors did have near-death experiences, and they were real. They weren't imagining these conversations. They were words which were actually spoken. But his discovery, which was surprising, and he wrote this up in Lancet, one of the great medical journals, in 2001. He wrote that the only people who have these near-death experiences are those who were brain dead at the time. Their brain is not functioning. What he found there, that when you have brain death, the brain stops working, is at that point the stream of consciousness leaves the body. And when it leaves the body there, floating above, it can hear and see everything which is going on, which in the Tibetan Book of the Dead means you give instructions because the person can hear and even see what you're doing. Those instructions should be not just specific to people who follow Tibetan Buddhism. It's whatever works for whatever person. They have to be tailor-made to the person. It's not one size fits all. Basically, it's to tell you to let go. Basically, it's to say what to do when you see that beautiful light. Here in this meditation retreat, you've heard me describe that light. That's the same thing you see in deep meditation when the five senses disappear. We call it nimitta. And very often I've said that those people who go into this type of meditation, which I've described on this retreat, you're going understanding what's going to happen to you when you actually die. The similarity with deep meditation and death is that in deep meditation, your five senses turn off. You can't see, you can't hear, smell, taste, or touch. That's the similarity with death. Your body dies and the five senses stop. And what happens next? You get to see the sixth sense, the jitta, the mind, which appears as this beautiful light. Whether it's in meditation or whether it's at death, it's the same sort of light you see. You have to understand what to do with that. Those on this retreat, you've heard me teach. When that nimitta comes up, don't be excited, don't be afraid. The same when you die, don't be excited, don't be afraid. Don't control, just let go. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with that light. And then you merge into that light and you go into an incredibly powerful state, if not ending rebirth altogether. So this is not the Tibetan Book of the Dead, this is the Australian Book of the Dead by Ajahn Brahm. Based on experience. So these are stages which you go through, which you can train yourself to do even when you're alive, through the practice of deep meditation called the jhanas right now. Go on.
Two possibilities. Either you die by accident or you die from illness.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that if a person is under medication, all right, and in great pain, is it really possible to really move towards this light? I read that book a long time ago and I didn't understand anything. But the thing is that I'm just wondering whether in that particular condition,
okay,
is it possible really to remain calm and to be able to really
go into the light, yeah.
Okay.
And I was told that there are, I mean, I remember the, a little bit of the book, is that there are few stages and there are other color lights that come along.
Okay.
And you're supposed to ignore that and wait for that one.
Okay.
How will anyone know it's that one?
Very good question. Now look, when you're under, say, dying from an accident, or if you're under medication, somebody asked me this afternoon, because many people die very slowly, maybe through cancers, and they have medication called morphine. And morphine makes you so dull, you're almost unconscious. You're in a very, very dull and sleepy state. And some Buddhists have asked me that we need to be very aware and mindful of this most important time of our life, our death. Is that a good thing to do? And I answered, it is a good thing to do, to take that morphine, because just before you die, the last couple of minutes, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, just when your mind, this sixth sense, separates from the body, that's when you regain your clarity. There's many, many examples of people who have been unconscious, dying, in a coma, and the last minute or two of their life have woken up. Basically become clear. A good example of that was in Time magazine, written by a doctor in the United States, The Weird Things About the Mind, when there was a guy who had a brain tumor, and a brain tumor was untreatable, was going to take over the whole brain, and basically all the functions which the brain did to preserve things like memory and speech, and then the other bodily functions, were going to be taken away slowly. A slow death over a couple of months. The tumor had grown to such a degree that the guy was comatose, hadn't spoken for a long time, and it's just the bodily functions of, I think, breathing was going to go pretty soon. So the family were by the bedside just waiting for him to breathe his last, when he opened his eyes, bent up, and spoke to the family for 15 minutes, saying his goodbyes before he fell back and died. There's no way that could happen according to the brain. That was an extreme case of something which even Tolstoy wrote about in a story from his own experience of a man in Russia over 100 years ago in extreme pain. No medication could take away his pain. He was screaming in agony 24 hours a day, not sleeping, sending everybody in the house crazy with the unbearable pain that he was exhibiting, until the house fell suddenly silent. And he was free of pain for 2 or 3 minutes before he died. That is common. The last couple of minutes of your life, no matter what pain you were in before, no matter what drugs were in your body, even if you're suffering from Alzheimer's disease, severe dementia, like my mother is currently in England, I know that her last minutes of her life will be clear. She won't recognize me now. But if I was with her at her last dying moment, she would probably open her eyes and say, Peter, what are you doing here? You're a monk. Because that is what happens, which is why just before you die, and certainly afterwards, you get clarity. And number two, as I mentioned to many of you here, colors are not important with that light. What is important is its beauty, its power. So all those questions I've actually asked, and I've answered, they're on tapes of all the instructions I've given in this retreat. Because this is what you learn through your meditation practice, how to deal with that light, how to be able to merge with it. Colors are not important. I know that as a fact, and I'd argue with anyone who actually says otherwise. What's important is beauty, intensity, stability of that light. So I say that to you now. When you die, if I've got it wrong, you come and haunt me. And I know you won't. Thank you for that question. Nice deep question. Any other questions got here? Yes?
The Mahayana is believed that spirits after they die, after a certain hours, we feel they are very fragile and they are in deep pain, even simply stroke.
Yeah. That was saying in Mahayana, they believe that just after they die, their consciousness is actually still connected to their body for quite a few hours afterwards, and if you stroke them or touch them, it might be interfere with their dying process. That actually came from, I think, Nagarjuna about a thousand years after the time of the Buddha. It was not in the original Buddhist teachings, and I again argue against that quite vehemently, not because I want to put down Mahayana, but because that really affects the person's dying process in a negative way. When they die, they are separated from their body. They can't feel their body at all. Yes, there's a connection there because they're looking over their body, there's still an attachment there. So you've got to respect the body, but you can actually touch it, and most importantly, you can donate your organs. I am an organ donor. I've got my card up in my room. I'm not a hypocrite. People know that when I die, whatever organ you want, you can have. Now imagine that you died and you were outside of your body and you were seeing the doctors take some of your organs, maybe to give a life to a kid who's got kidney failure, so that child can actually live a full life. That your heart may go to some other girl just like you, whose husband is desperate for his wife to recover so they can have children, but she's got heart failure. That your liver and other things can go to people, even your cornea of your eyes, can go to a person who needs that so they can see. And you're seeing that you're giving this incredible dana out of compassion for other people who are sick, who need a life. How would you feel if that was you as a spirit seeing that happen? Yeah, you feel so inspired. You feel, I'm really making big time dana. You can give ang paos. You can put 10,000 ringgit into an ang pao. 100,000, a million, that's nothing compared to giving a kidney to a person who's been in dialysis for years. Have you been to dialysis centers? Have you seen people there having to go there 3 or 4 times a week, sitting there or lying down there, as their blood is cleansed with these machines? You're giving them a life if you give your kidney. So I'm saying that if you're Mahayana, Vajrayana, or Theravada, Christian, Muslim, or whatever, that is good karma, that is good stuff. You will never be harmed in this life or the next by doing such a great act of compassion and kindness, like giving an organ. You won't feel any pain, even though I know that the doctors actually have to harvest the organ before you're actually clinically dead. It's in those last few minutes when your mind has separated from the body, you don't feel any pain at all. Instead, you actually see this doctor taking out your organs to give to someone else. Wow, that's brilliant. You feel so inspired that your body is going to give life, peace, hope to not just one person, to many people. And that's how you die, with that thought in your mind of having done great good karma. There was this monk over in Sri Lanka some years ago. He was a kidney donor, and he used to give blood regularly. And when you give blood, they know your blood type, and he said if anyone needs a kidney, they can have one. And they had a person who needed a kidney in Sri Lanka. This person had both kidneys were failed. He was in dialysis to keep himself alive. And the blood type matched. There's only one problem. And the problem was the person who needed this monk's kidney was evangelical Christian, who was going around Sri Lanka converting the Buddhists to being Christians. So they asked this monk, fellow needs your kidney, but he's converting your people to being Christian. What do you think? There wasn't even a pause. Of course he can have my kidney. And he gave this pastor his kidney. That's a Buddhist. Don't care who is getting your kidney. If they need it, they can have it. This is generosity, asking nothing back in return, and having to go through the pain of that operation and the danger for the rest of his life. He's usually okay having one kidney, but it's a bit of a risk. If he did that, that is a really good monk. So if he could do that, by example, please, each one of you become organ donors. I've just seen too much suffering people and their families because someone's waiting for a heart, for a liver or whatever. And people are just too superstitious to offer it. So be an organ donor. Compassionate. If you want to give, it doesn't cost you anything. It just gets burnt or buried and eaten by worms. So give. Thank you for that question. Yes.
He died too.
Yes.
How many?
The third time was lately.
Third time lately?
A few months ago.
Very good. Very good. I think all your friends are going to be very scared if you come to visit them. No, it's actually a very good thing you did. And the reason it's a good thing you did, because in those particular cases, they were very close to death. They just needed some help. Going that last step, and you compassionately gave them that help. As I said, the dying is not the end of the world. We get reborn again afterwards. It's not whether we die or we don't die, it's how we die is most important. And you help them die peacefully and well without fear. Too many people at the end of their life, they find it difficult to die because of fear. In the same way that many of you meditating find it difficult to stay with the breath or stay with the nimitta because you're control freaks. So please learn how to let go and die peacefully. You help them let go. Well done. You can come to my bedside when I'm sick. No, you don't. You've been very compassionate and kind. Well done. So if anybody has a relation who's difficult to die, they're in great pain, this is the lady to invite.
Visit
them, because you'll find that sometimes that these are only people on the very edge of death and you just manage to help them over. Most people, you go and visit them, they will actually survive. So it's only because, don't be afraid, I know exactly what you've done, you just help them get over that last piece of fear so they can actually die well. Congratulations. Okay, yes, last question, then I'll go for questions in the box.
Is there any truth to it that in the period preceding to a person's death, and people have premonitions of seeing their ancestors, they see ghosts, they see fire, and people like me to go towards the lower realms?
Okay.
For those who see Buddhas and monasteries.
Yeah. I've heard this many times, that just the last day or so before you die, or the last hour or two or a few minutes before you die, you do have sometimes premonitions, and sometimes they are signs of your destination. So, you know, if you actually do get premonitions of terrible things, then you better act pretty quickly. So get a monk by the bedside so they can see the beautiful monk by the bedside. That's the last thing they see instead of these fire or hell beings, because the last thought is really important. And that's why I told this story. This was a story about a man from KL who had a big shop, and he was what we call a Waisak Buddhist, which means he only goes to the temple one day a year. And that's only because his wife scolds him if he doesn't. But he hated going to the temple. Number one, he had to keep 5 precepts, which he didn't like. And number two, he had to give donation, which he hated. And number three, he was wasting his time listening to these boring sermons. But he went there just to keep his wife happy. Are you married, sir? I think you may understand him. But one day he went to the temple and he heard the sermon. He got nothing else to do. And he heard the monk say, the most important thing is your last thought before you die. And the monk also said, if you can think of, say, the triple gem, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, before you die, you're guaranteed of going to heaven. Now that's actually true. And so this man, this business person from KL, thought, is that all I need to do to go to heaven? You mean I don't need to keep precepts? And I don't need to give ang pao to these fat monks? And I don't need to go to temple? That's all I need to do. And he thought, wow, at last I don't need to go to temple, not even on Waisak Day. I've just got to make sure I can think of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha before I die. How can I do that? And then a light bulb went on in his head. He figured it out. He had the perfect way to make sure that his last thought would be about Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. Because you see, he had these three sons. The following day he renamed them. The eldest one Buddha, the middle one Dhamma and the youngest one Sangha. Because you know, in our Chinese tradition, your sons have to be there at your bedside when you die. So he never actually went to temple ever again, never gave donations, started drinking whiskey, who cares, he's going to go to heaven. And his plan was working perfectly. He was getting very sick, he was on his deathbed, he knew he was going to go, so he called his three sons and he saw them there next to his bedside. He only had maybe a few minutes before he died. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Okay, he was so happy. But just before he died, a thought came to his mind. If my three sons are here, who's looking after my shop? And that's when he died. So you can't beat the system. Sort of, if you're a good person and you've actually, you know, been doing good things all your life, your last thought will be a good one. So, you know, if you do happen to see sort of premonitions and they're bad ones, get monks, get tapes, whatever, to try and see what you can do to get some good last thoughts there. And if that doesn't work, name your son Buddha or Dhamma. Do something there to get a good feeling there. But yeah, I've heard that before and it seems it's actually true. Because, you know, when you die, your mind gets very, starts separating from your body early. And, you know, as it starts separating from your body, you're not dead yet, but you do get sort of these visions of where you're going to go. But, you know, sometimes those visions or you know, you see the person afterwards, after they're dead. And sometimes that's why we transfer merits, because you actually see them that they're actually been reborn in a lower realm, or they're lacking things, so you transfer merits to actually to get them into a much better state. Now this afternoon I also told the story of the tsunami ghost the other day, didn't I? Yeah. About just how by giving a Buddhist funeral to this English girl that she became a deva and thanked everybody by giving a lottery number. And I told that story at the Malaysian Buddhist cooperative, and people in the front row said actually their loved one, was it their husband, that came to them in a dream and told them the lottery number 3 times, but she didn't gamble, so she never bought the number, but it won 3 times. So I told her, if that happens to you and you don't gamble, please tell the temple, because they will put some money on to pay the bill. Okay, does that answer your question, sir? Okay, I'll just... Okay.
What about dreaming of other people who are dead come back in dreams to the living?
Okay, if you dream of people who are dead coming back to you, if it's just one dream, it could just be coincidence. But if it keeps coming back again and again and again, that's very probably the case that they're actually asking for something or telling you something.
Sorry?
They're asking for something or they're telling you something.
Yeah, but most of the time in a dream, when you dream of somebody who is dead, there is no communication. It's just I read about it that sometimes you see the expression, if they are happy, you know, they have cheerful flow, then they are happy in the other world.
Yeah.
In that dimension, or you know, in the Buddhist philosophy. But if you are sad looking, then there's something they are not happy about.
That's right. That's where you have to sort of make good karma for them.
But sometimes, the reason I ask this is because I have dreamt about a couple of people who are dead. One is my mother. 2 years ago, she died. She passed away. Another one was a very close friend, and I don't know what actually, I cannot decipher what they actually wanted me.
Okay, if that's the case, that you had two recurring dreams, one of your mother, she died a couple of years ago, it's still probably the case that your mother is concerned about you and just maybe looking after you. So it's not that she wants something, but she's actually looking after you. If that dream recurs, after a while you get the message of what they need, if they do want something. If it's a close friend, it's more the case that they need something from you. And so that's the case that when you have that dream the next time, see if you can remember it and see what they need or what they want. I know there was this one woman who had a dream of her ex-husband. And, okay, it's a joke. Because just before her husband died, he put in his last will and testament that he wanted to be put in his coffin without any clothes on, totally naked. And his wife argued with him, look, we can afford a suit for you, and you're rich anyway. You know, why can't we dress you well in your coffin? And he said, look, I am a rich person, I got lots of money, and that's only because I've never wasted anything in my whole life. What do I need clothes for in my coffin? I know where I'm going, down there, and you don't need clothes, it's so hot. And because it was his last will and testament, his wife had no choice but to put him naked in his coffin. And it was only about a week later she dreamt of him. And he came to her in a dream, sort of naked and shivering. And he said, have you not got my old golfing trousers and my old gardening jumper? Can you please send that to me? And his wife was quite surprised. And he said, I thought you went to hell. He said, I did, but there's so many rich people down there, they've installed aircon. Ha ha ha.
I remember telling that joke to the chief referee at Brickfields, he laughed.
But no, if it is really, if it's really a memory of your mum or a friend, if they haven't, if they're asking for something, they'll keep coming back until they, you get the message of what they want. And until that time, just leave it open and see what happens. That's all you can really do. But very often they are asking for something. That's a meditation question. I'll do meditation questions tomorrow morning. Okay, that's... I'll mention this now, because I did mention earlier today about, as far as the evidence says, it's very strong evidence to say the Buddha did not teach Abhidhamma. And the question here is it true the Buddha taught Abhidhamma to his mother in Atusita heaven? That's what it says in the commentaries, that the Buddha taught Abhidhamma to his mother in Atusita heaven. Not anywhere in these scriptures here, you see. But in those scriptures it does say his mother wasn't in Atusita heaven anyway. His mother was in Atusita heaven. The commentaries say he taught the Abhidhamma in the Tawatingsa heaven. So they even got that one wrong. But that's actually a scholastic question, which doesn't really relate to real life. My healthy 83-year-old mother was found in a paying homage to the Buddha position, dead within 8 minutes of phoning my brother, complaining of tiredness. That's interesting. 83-year-old mother was found in a paying homage to the Buddha position, dead within 8 minutes of phoning my brother, complaining of tiredness. After the funeral, she communicated in a dream to a devout lawyer that she's now in a happy place, not far from the Buddha's level. I should be grateful to you for an explanation. It's brilliant, because her last thought was obviously of the Buddha. She was actually found praying in that situation when she died. And obviously she's just come back to tell her family that she's doing wonderful. She's, because of her devotion, and the last thought was a beautiful one, she's in a very happy place. Brilliant, well done. Okay, this is a meditation question. I'm just going through these because... Ajahn Brahm, what makes you choose Buddhism over other religions? What aspects of Buddhism appeal to you the most? It's the hairstyle. Now, how expensive is it to go to hairdressers? And even you pay all this money to go to hairdressers, you still have bad hair day. And you have to carry a comb and a brush with you wherever you go. People are always taking photographs of me. I never need to brush my hair. So easy. No, actually, quite seriously, that when I was about 15 or 16, I got my first school prize. And I mentioned one of the books I got was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But it was supposed to be for mathematics. And so it was the first time I ever got a school prize. So, you know, in primary school, they didn't give out school prizes, even though I came top there and went to a really good scholarship to a good high school. It was Latimer School in London. And then, but then I was like a small fish in a big pond. It took me a long time to work my way up, you know, to get towards the top of the class in the big high school. But there was at A levels I started coming good. It's really good idea to start coming good at the very end of your school career, not the beginning. So that's when I really started to excel. So I got my first school prize for A level results, and my teacher said, "Go and get some books on mathematics, so you can actually improve, you know, your skills." And so I went to this big bookshop in London, Foyles in Charing Cross Road, and looked in the mathematics section. And my God, they were boring books. And I thought, I am not going to waste my very first school prize on that rubbish. On the opposite side of the road, there was the annex. On the top story of the annex was the books on religion, occult sciences, psychology, all the interesting stuff. But especially, I thought at that time, religion was important. But what religion should I choose? Just because I was born in a Christian country, why should I be a Christian? I thought I should exercise my choice. But before I chose,
I should do what we call these days market research. So I got a book on all the different types of religions, read them all. I did market research on religion before choosing. And when I read my first book on Buddhism, it was an amazing experience. It wasn't that I was converted to being a Buddhist. It was a discovery that I had been a Buddhist for a long time. The way I looked at the world, my philosophy, even things like belief in reincarnation, I already believed in that. I don't know where I got that from. But I already was a Buddhist. And now I found out that my beliefs were shared with millions of other people throughout the world. When I've told that story, many other people, especially in countries like Australia or Europe or United States, have come up and said that's exactly what happened to them. They listened to a talk on Buddhism or they read a book and said, my goodness, that's who I am. I'm a Buddhist. And they never knew before. So that's how I became a Buddhist. It fit so well with my science. You are always allowed to question. I say today there are two types of religion. The first type of religion is where you bend the facts to fit your faith. Bending the facts to fit your faith. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. You'll twist it if your faith says otherwise. And the other one is where you bend your faith to fit the facts. Buddhism is of the second type. It doesn't matter what is said in those books. It doesn't matter what a monk says. If it doesn't fit the facts, you reject what the Buddha said to fit the facts. Now that's Buddhism, Kalama Sutta. Fortunately, what the Buddha said, I've investigated it for so many years, it actually fits the facts. Incredibly sometimes. For example, I was a theoretical physicist. The age of the universe so far, since the Big Bang, is somewhere between 13 and 14 billion years. That's 13 to 14,000 million years. There is one place in the Anguttara Nikaya, one of those books, which gives you an estimate of how old, or sorry, the age of a full universe cycle. It's actually that sutta where it says, the first level of heavenly beings, they live to 100 celestial years, and one day in celestial years is worth 100 human years. So I could actually work out the age of that celestial being in human years. The next level is four times longer, the next level four times longer than that, until you get to the Brahma realm, which lasts a whole eon. It gave me a very quick calculation of how long an eon is. And it worked out to 36,000 million years, give or take a million. It's a thousand million. So that's actually in the ballpark. If the Buddha said that one whole universe cycle is between 36 and 37,000 million years, we've done about 13 or 14,000 million years. We're not quite halfway yet, but we're close. That's ballpark. Science says, wow, that's actually credible. Christianity says this world has only lasted 6 or 7,000 years. That's not credible at all, according to science. So it's things like that, as a scientist, and I looked at Buddhism and, wow, this Buddhism is so in tune with modern science. Even the Buddha saying this, many, many universes, now not just, it's not the first one, this is the one we're currently in, there's been uncountable many others. Professor Carl Epstein of UCLA, in his brain theory, that's B-R-A-N-E, predicted a serial number of Big Bangs, not just one, but many. And even as one of the suttas over there that was saying, yes, there are other planets with life in it. Not, this is not the only planet with beings in it. And thousand-fold world systems with many beings in many different places. That's in the Anguttara Nikaya again. That's incredible that this guy, 2,500 years ago, was actually saying such things. It's brilliant stuff. That's why that when I read that Buddhism, I thought, that makes so much sense. And when he started meditating, my goodness, it really makes sense. Many articles have been written on how to handle depression arising from menopause and andropause for men. What do they say about menopause? That means when you stop pause having no men. So, that's an old, a woman told me that joke. Is there any Buddhist means or ways to handle such depression? Of course there is. Look, there's a physical feelings in the body, and if you can accept those physical feelings and not fight them, make peace with them, be kind to them, so if the mental part of that gets much, much less. You know, you're just going through some physical stuff, so rest. You know, balance the body, you know, with the right foods or whatever. Meditate is brilliant, because that gets rid of depression. As I said the other day, that's the preferred treatment by the British National Health Service and also the Canadian National Health Service, I was told. Meditation cures depression. Can Ajahn share with us inspiring cases of people with cancer whose cancer disappears after taking up meditation, Buddhist therapy, chanting, and so on? Did I tell about George? I didn't think I'd already told about George getting rid of his cancer. He's the English guy who, in 1 or 2 weeks, his lungs were totally full of cancer, and through meditation, in 2 weeks, the cancer totally disappeared. No cancer left at all. You know, one of my favorite monks, he passed away about 5 years ago. And when I first went to Thailand, he was called Ajahn Tate, one of Ajahn Mun's great disciples, a very beautiful monk. I saw him and I just, when you go into the presence of a great monk like that, you never want to leave. There's so much kindness and compassion. It's amazing. When I first went to Thailand 36 years ago, he was just released from Sirirat Hospital because his cancer was incurable. He went up to his monastery to die. It was about 25, 26 years later that he died of old age. So I've known so many cases of people who have been sent home from the hospital because they're untreatable, they're going to die. And it's old age kills them, not the cancer. They live a long, 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 long time. So it happens, there's heaps of cases like that. Other religions like Christianity and Islam teaches that the universe is created by a creator God. From Buddhist point of view, how does this universe come about? What happens when the universe ends, and is there a beginning? What Buddhism teaches is very close to modern science, a beginning called the Big Bang, but coming according to natural laws, not a being who creates it. The problem, as many philosophers and even kids know, if there is a first cause, if God created the universe, then who created God? And it just puts the question back a step. So actually thinking there is a creator, ask the question, who created the creator? And it just goes on and on and on. However, the way that Buddhism understands the origin of this universe, it goes according to what I call Murphy's Law. You know Murphy's Law? If it can go wrong, it does go wrong. In other words, if it can happen, it does happen. And that is actually quantum physics. If it can happen, it does happen. There is something in quantum physics called Hawking radiation. This is how black holes decay. Now, you may know black holes, which keep sucking in any sort of mass or energy in close range. They suck in and they can't get out. And it was, of course, Stephen Hawking from Cambridge, who showed that no, you can actually have black holes decaying. And the process by which this happens is that you can have something in physics called spontaneous particle creation. A particle and its antiparticle. They can come into being for a very short time. And if they come into being, if it can happen, it does happen, close to a black hole, one goes into the black hole, the other one goes out, and that is effectively radiation. And Professor Hawking, his name is on that phenomena. Hawking radiation is an example that doesn't matter about the beginning of this world, creation is happening right now, every moment. Things are being created out of nothing. And people have asked me as a scientist, how can you create things out of nothing? Because one of the fundamental principles of science is the conservation of mass energy. You can neither create nor destroy mass energy. And I gave a talk in Singapore about a week ago, and I mentioned at that talk I was giving a
seminar together with our local professor of physics, Professor David Blair at University of Western Australia. You know, I'm really well connected with a physicist, even now. The professor of physics at Curtin University, Mario, keeps coming to my lectures. So I'm so well connected with his professors of physics in Western Australia that when Sir Roger Penrose came into Australia, he was the guy who found black holes, one of the great physicists, maybe not quite as famous as Professor Stephen Hawking, because that was the guy who wrote The Brief History of Time. You know, but Roger Penrose, he was the guy who found black holes. Very famous guy. So he came along to Perth, and guess who was invited to dinner with Roger Penrose? I was, because I had all my connections with the professors of physics. And I was the only person of religion there at the table. I was sitting next to someone from NASA, a professor from physics who was visiting from, I think, Stanford or something. And we had a great time talking. So I'm really still well connected there. So at this lecture I was giving with Professor David Blair, who was actually that year the Australian Science Professor of the Year, I just mentioned to him, he said, look, I know from my science there is something in physics we call negative energy. An example of that which you should know from your school physics is potential energy. If you take a massive object, say in the Earth's gravitational field, to release it from that field, basically to take it into outer space, it takes a lot of energy. It has to lose energy to be free. So its inner field is in a negative energy state. So I said, look, there is negative energy. What would happen, I asked him, if the amount of negative energy in this universe exactly equaled the amount of positive energy? So actually this is a zero-sum energy universe. And he turned around and looked with surprise and respect. He said, my goodness, you're up to date. Because only recently they discovered that omega equals one, and omega is the ratio of those two factors. He said, that's actually true. If all the mass energy in this universe came into one spot, it would exactly cancel it out to come to absolute nothingness, emptiness, sunyata. That's where this universe has come from. It's a zero-sum universe, which is why it can come from nothing without a creator. Positive energy and negative energy exactly, perfectly cancel each other out. It's so beautiful. And that's why I love science, because when you really understood science, it was beautiful. Intellectually, so satisfying, just like Buddhism was. Or is, sorry. There you go, I'll get passionate about this because I love that sort of stuff. Will a person sleep beside a meditator who meditates every night benefit from the meditative energy? That's a good question. You might say, will the person meditating all night be dragged down by the sleeper next to them? But actually, it is actually true that. These meditators over here, I've noticed this. This is just having meditated for such a long time. If there's a monk in my monastery who gets a very deep meditation that night, nearly all the monks have a good meditation. It's really weird, but it's as if one meditator really gets deep, it's like an energy which resonates throughout the whole monastery and everyone else gets very deep. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I try and meditate with you guys. I try and get you deeper. By means of getting deep and resonating, making you go deeper, it does actually work that way. I'm not quite sure how it works, but I've seen it happen. You mentioned if our departed ones are reborn in the human realm, then they will not be able to receive the merits we transferred. How will I know if my beloved Papa is in which realm? Hungry ghosts, animal, human, devas, or asuras? It's very hard to know, but sometimes you may see someone in your family who reminds you of your dad. That's happened many, many times. Because rebirth often happens in the same family. So if that's your father who's died,
look for a new child being born in your family. You know, maybe 10 months after your father passed away. Sometimes less than that. And it's amazing how many times that people have told me that that new child, it might be my sister's child, he looks so like Papa. And later on you find, it is Papa. One of my friends, I was with him about a week ago, his aunt died. She was a very wealthy woman, had no husband, and when she died, she gave her property, shared it with her family. About 10 months later, his wife gave birth to a daughter. And of course, everybody came round to see the new addition to the family, and they all said, that looks like our aunt. There's only a baby, of course. But when it started to speak, he'd inherited the crockery from her mansion. Daddy, Daddy, give me my cup, that's my cup. Passing by the place where I'm at, Daddy, Daddy, take me to my home, I want to go to my home. Again and again and again, she showed that she was her father's aunt, now her father's daughter. That happens so often. One of the funniest cases was this Thai girl who's a support of our monastery in Perth. And she told me that she remembered her previous life. In her previous life, she had many children, but one of her sons did very well at school, went to university, and came back to the village to be the headmaster of the school. And when the headmaster's mother died, she was reborn as his niece. And that's the girl who's in Perth right now. And she said that when in the village she was old enough to speak, her memories of her previous life were so clear that everybody realized that in her previous life she was the headmaster's mother. In this life, his niece. So when she went to school, in the schoolroom in Thailand years ago, just like in Malaysia or Singapore, when the teacher comes into the room, especially the headmaster, everyone has to stand up. She refused to stand up. I should not stand up for my son. He should stand up for me. So this little six-year-old would never stand up. And she could be as naughty as she wanted because the headmaster could not cane her. How on earth can you cane your mother? She said she had a great time in school. She never learned very much. But when your headmaster's your son from a previous life, you know, you're sweet. You don't have to do homework. That's a true story. So that's sometimes what happens, that sometimes they get reborn in the family. So check it out. See if there's any new addition to the family about the right time. Otherwise, it's very hard to know. Okay, I'm not going to be able to answer all these questions because we've only got another 5 minutes, so I'm just going to take a few out at random. And if you've got good karma, your question will be answered. If you haven't got good karma, tough luck. I find I've been praising myself whenever I did something good. Worse still, I even imagine being praised by others. Is this egotistical? How to overcome pride and ego? I just told you a few days ago, if you do something good, praise yourself. Look in the mirror and say, well done, me. Because if you praise yourself for doing good things, you'll do more good things. And you'll not get a bigger ego. If you praise someone, they don't get a big head. They get a big heart. If you praise them for their kindness, their generosity, their compassion, you're encouraging those qualities. And by encouraging the good qualities in yourself and in others, you are creating a much better world. So please praise that which is worthy of praise. Puja cha pujaniyanang etam mangalamutamang, said the Buddha in the Mangala Sutta. To praise that which is worthy of praise. It's actually worship, but it's the same thing.
Praise that which is worthy of praise in yourself and others, and then you encourage in good qualities. Read about abnormal people being exorcised by Christian priests. How could they know the difference between a schizophrenic, a madman, and an abnormal person? And from a Buddhist view, is it possible to exorcise? Indeed, I know many people who have been killed by those Christian exorcists. Now, I'm serious. So sometimes they do this, they've got good ideas, but they're stupid there because their beliefs don't accord with reality, especially in what they think is possessions. So Ajahn Chah once, heard this story is an opening the door of your heart. This is the brilliance of a Buddhist. There was a mad woman in the village. The head man of the village came to see him early in the morning to say this woman had been possessed the night before. They could do nothing with her. She was absolutely crazy. And they were bringing her to see the great master Ajahn Chah. And as they said this to Ajahn Chah, you could hear her screaming obscenities at the monastery gate. As about three or four really strong Thai farmers dragged her in. Now, people were so respectful of monks, especially of Ajahn Chah, that no one would speak like that in a monastery. Now, she really was out of her mind. And what did Ajahn Chah do? He shouted at a couple of novice monks, "I want a hole dug, a big hole. Dig it now, quick." And the other novice monk, "I want some water boiled, lots of it. Start a fire, boil some water." And we hadn't got a clue what Ajahn Chah was up to. Then as they took the time to drag this woman into his presence, the poor novices were frantically digging as hard as they could. And someone else had started the fire and was boiling water. And Ajahn Chah said, "Quick, we need it quicker. Deeper hole, boil that water faster." And as they brought this woman in to see him, her face was, and her mouth was foaming, her eyes were wide, and she was trying to lunge at Ajahn Chah. And as the men were trying all they could to stop her attacking Ajahn Chah, she was absolutely out of her mind and crazy. And it was frightening to see. The person had so much strength, as you do when you're mad. And all Ajahn Chah would do, "Quick, we need a bigger hole. Is the water boiled yet?" And then we found out what he was planning to do. He said, "That's a very, very dangerous spirit who's possessed that woman. The only thing we can do is to throw that woman in the hole, pour boiling water all over her and bury her. That's the only thing we can do." Now, Ajahn Chah was so unpredictable that even I thought he might do that. Certainly that crazy woman thought he might do that, and she started to calm down. Self-preservation kicked in, and before that water was boiled and the hole was dug, she was sitting calmly in front of him, taking the five precepts. That was absolutely brilliant, because Ajahn Chah knew something about deep psychology. Self-preservation, no matter if you're schizophrenic or if you really are possessed, if you really think this monk is going to throw you in a hole and pour boiling water over you, then bury you, you get your act together pretty quick. And that's how he exercised, whether it's schizophrenia or a spirit, and that woman just walked slowly and calmly, totally exhausted, back to the village for a big sleep. Wasn't that brilliant? That's what I call wisdom. Okay, the last question looks a good one. Is lust... Why are you all interested? Is lust the biggest hindrance to meditation? How to overcome lust? Thanks a lot. Look where lust has got you. Into big trouble. So look, you see a beautiful woman, you guys, and as soon as, she wears beautiful clothes and makeup and scent, and as soon as you're married, no more beautiful clothes, no more scent, no more makeup.
At least not as much as they did when they're going out with you. All nice and sweet and nice. But as soon as they've got you, you're in big trouble. That's why we call the rings handcuffs. And you ladies as well. You had such a wonderful time when you were single. You go out and enjoy yourself. And as soon as you get married, there you are. All these problems and difficulties. And your guy, again, he was so sweet and nice to you when you were going out. Always saying nice things. And now he complains. Those of you who've been married for many years, was that the guy you used to go out with? Sometimes I think, is that him? Now what? What lust does for a man, as you all know, all the blood goes from the brain to somewhere else, so he's not thinking right at all. So it is a hindrance to life, actually, lust. Obviously you have some lust, but look, keep it. Lust actually makes you crazy. You know, you do actually lose a lot of your common sense when you have lust. So that's why, you know, just, if you do have lust, be careful, it's very dangerous. You have a lot of fun as well. I mean, you know, you're not monks or nuns. So, you know, enjoy your life, but be careful with lust because it can break up your marriage. It can just cause the ruin of your family reputation and lose a huge amount of money. And why is it? Just because of the lust. So be very careful. It's a great power. It can create lots of pleasure, but it's also very dangerous, like any other great power. So be careful with it. And how to overcome lust? If you really want to overcome lust, whoever answers this question, the only real way to overcome lust, you've got it, become a monk or a nun. Okay, this has to be the very last question, 10 o'clock. And the other questions I will try and answer tomorrow morning, but they're mostly meditation questions. Thanks, Triple Gem, for inviting Ajahn Brahm to watch Etuan for all of us. Also, thank Triple Gem for working so hard to make it a success. Very good. Thanks, Ajahn Brahm, for all your inspiration, motivation, care, and compassionate talks. You share your knowledge generously and teach us without holding any tricks back. We all love you. Come back to KL. You're welcome again and again. I deserve that. So very good. Again, for those of you on retreat here, it hasn't finished yet. If I told you on retreat, there's how many 140 people on retreat, 139 of you have got enlightened and you're the only one not. So now have a nice night. Be peaceful, be calm, but remember, retreat isn't over until everybody leaves. So that's like life. Sometimes we waste so much time in life. And life isn't finished yet, but our mind has finished it. So remember, make sure you enjoy every moment of your life. When death comes, you think, my goodness, I wasted so much time. My saying is this, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. So don't do all the unimportant things. Do the things which are really important first. And then, if you do die, even tonight or the next night or the sometime afterwards, you will know that all the important things in life you've got out of the way first. And the less important things you don't need to worry about. And what are the important things in life? Not yet. Is actually forgiving those people who have hurt you. And you ask forgiveness of people you have hurt. Expressing your love to your family and friends before it's too late. Because I remember I never expressed my love enough to my father. And he died and it was too late. And I regret that. Express the love to the people who are really fond of and you care about. Be kind and be generous while you still have the time to do so. Who knows, the economy might crash tomorrow and you won't be able to give those donations. Do it while you can. Be kind, be generous. Keep those precepts while you're still in a position to do so. Listen to the Dhamma where there's still good monks or good nuns around. They go very quickly and who knows when they might come back again. And practice meditation.
while you've still got the health and the opportunity to do so.
Basically, grab the moment, because the moments don't come again. That's the most important thing in life. Thank you all for listening.